I'm Angelo Pulveri, KA9CSO, with the rain report. In this edition, Joe Taylor, K1JT, a Nobel laureate.
This is the rain report. I'm Half Holly, KC9RP, speaking today with a Nobel laureate, which I've never had the honor or pleasure of doing. His name is Joe Taylor, Dr. Joe Taylor, K1JT. Joe is the Dean of Faculty and a professor of physics at Princeton University, won a Nobel Prize for physics back in 1993, which we'll talk about a little bit later. First of all, Joe, thanks very much for spending some time with me today on the Rain Report.
Happy, it's a pleasure to talk with you, and it would be even more fun to do it on the air, but let's do it on the phone.
Very good indeed. Joe, let's go back to your beginning in ham radio. How did you get started and when?
I took my novice test in 1954 at the age of 13. I had been interested in radios then for a few years and had a brother just a year and a half older than I. He and I got together, taught ourselves the code, and studied up enough to pass the novice test.
But why?
Why indeed? I think probably the same kinds of urges that today get lots of kids interested in computers. We were kind of techies, or at least what passed for that same kind of thing in the 1950s. We happened to live and grow up on a farm in southern New Jersey, a peach farm, and therefore were not in a urban or even suburban situation. We were our own two best friends, and somehow got interested in the intricacies of electronics, or what we could understand of that at the ages of 12 and 13 and thereabouts. I think we clearly had a bent toward doing technical, possibly scientific kinds of things at that age, and indeed those turned out to be the courses that we followed in our later lives.
Tell me more about how amateur radio influenced your career to go into astrophysics.
Well, we had really great fun with the amateur radio parts of what we were doing as kids. Although we were into all the other kinds of things kids are into, sports and the like, our love and our hobby was ham radio through our high school and even college years. I think we were at the time also discovering kinds of things that we knew we enjoyed doing and therefore were worth putting the time into to become adept at. We had lots of fun doing things like taking apart junked television sets, which in those days were full of parts that you actually could make out what they were rather than the much more highly integrated machinery you find today. And, we literally took apart TV sets and put the pieces back together to make ham transmitters and receivers. And that was the kind of thing that you bought the ARRL handbook and a few other simple things and could learn enough even without much external instruction. A couple of boys could learn enough to make that sort of thing achievable as a goal.
What happened to you after high school?
Yeah, well, after high school, it was more or less expected in my family that the kids would go on to college, and indeed I did, happily. I knew that was what my parents had expected and aspired to for me. And I actually, in high school, had taken the usual courses that a college-bound student would take, including physics and chemistry and the like. I didn't really know much about what physics was, I think, but knew that at least if electronics fit anywhere short of a full engineering type study, it was something that came out of the study of physics. So I went off to college thinking probably I was a math major, but conceivably interested in doing physics. It wasn't too long after starting in college that I discovered I enjoyed my time in physics labs more than the proving of theorems and so forth that math students do, and made the transition then to what I was studying into physics. There's no question that the skills and interests I'd already gained in the joys of building electronic equipment and getting it to work had a lot to do with my quick accession to the joys of spending time in a physics laboratory. Probably long about the beginning of my final year as an undergraduate, I woke up, as many 21-year-olds or thereabouts do, nearing the end of of some time of studying in college, to realize that this is about over and something else has to come next. And I think at that point I was sufficiently well along and had received enough sort of positive feedback from my studies and teachers and the like that I was game to tackle things that were above and beyond that level, but still in the educational regime. So I was thinking about graduate school, and when thinking about an area of graduate study that I would enjoy doing, basically settled on doing radio astronomy because it seemed to be a good match between my physics background. Basically, I was looking for a field of physics in which to do postgraduate research type study, and the radio astronomy sort of merged the radio interest and skills that I had, which largely were derived from ham radio, an application of the physics that I'd been studying in a field that just seemed at that time opening up with new possibilities. The space age had just begun, sort of the astronomical world was moving rapidly toward new discoveries and new possibilities. And putting all this together, I think, is what led me to head off to Harvard University to pursue a graduate degree there in astrophysics.
What year was this?
I graduated from my undergraduate institution, Haverford College, in 1963, and headed off to grad school then in September of that year, which was at Harvard, and I finished that degree 4.5 years later.
You graduated from Harvard in 1967. Where'd you go then?
I stayed on, actually, at Harvard for about a year and a half as a postdoctoral research fellow and lecturer, so I was beginning at college and university level teaching career at that point, and sort of had a part research and part teaching position there. I moved on soon afterwards to a regular faculty ladder type position at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, so 100 miles west of Boston. And of course, it was during these years in Massachusetts that I acquired the W1 call or K1 call. I'd been K2ITP in the years in New Jersey before that. Spent 13 years on the faculty at the University of Massachusetts Amherst pursuing my interests in radio astronomy, beginning actually helping to put together a sizable research and teaching group there in that field. I maintained certainly my interest and my love of ham radio during those years, but was not terribly active for most of them. I spent a sabbatical year in 1976 at the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization just outside Sydney in Australia, and I had a VK2 call during that year and took a rig with me and kept in contact with my brother back in New Jersey. But in fact, except for that excursion and a few other intervals when I sort of had some time to get re-engaged, I really wasn't very active during most of those years on the ham bands, and instead was starting a family, spending a lot of time on my research and teaching.
I'm speaking today with Nobel laureate Dr. Joe Taylor, K1JT, professor of physics and dean of faculty at Princeton University. We'll be right back. This is the Rain Report. Back to my interview with Dr. Joe Taylor, K1JT, Nobel Prize winner in physics from 1993.
During that time at UMass, had a fascinating sequence of interesting and very intellectually rewarding activities in the research that I was doing, including a discovery that was an astonishing find and one that potentially was scientifically very important, and certainly put a great deal of my research time effort into developing that as much as I could into something that would be a significant contribution to the field of astrophysics and in fact, to fundamental physics. That work began to attract a fair bit of attention in the scientific world, and when in the late 1970s I was invited to consider joining the faculty here at Princeton University. I, in the end, accepted that offer and transferred here in 1980, and so moved my family back here to the New Jersey area.
Do I assume it's work led up to your Nobel Prize?
Yeah, it is indeed, and that's absolutely right. And as I explained briefly earlier, I had chosen this field of radio astronomy for my graduate study. Radio astronomy is basically just the field of astronomy approached through radio wavelengths, and means that the telescopes are giant antennas pointed upward instead of horizontally or elsewhere. And many hams are familiar with the big antennas scattered around the country, such as the Arecibo Radio Telescope in Puerto Rico and a big facility in West Virginia, as well as a whole array of telescopes in the plains of San Augustine in the state of New Mexico, and others around the country as well. My own work involved the study of pulsars. A pulsar is an object created in a supernova explosion when certain types of very high-mass stars have exhausted all of their nuclear fusion potential fuel in their cores. They become unstable and sort of simultaneously implode and explode. There's some outer layers of gas that are blown off into the general interstellar medium, and the inner material implodes and basically becomes converted from atomic matter, like almost everything is, to nuclear matter, where the spaces between the electrons and nuclei in atoms are essentially crushed out of existence by the immense forces of gravity. So a neutron star is created in that implosion. It is material that has stopped just a very whisker short of having become a black hole. And it turns out by mechanisms that were discovered quite accidentally in the late 1960s, just about the time I was finishing my PhD degree, to create objects which have come to be known as pulsars because they emit pulses of radiation that are detectable over interstellar distances with big radio telescopes. They have masses comparable to those of ordinary stars. Typical mass of a pulsar is about 1.4 times the mass of our sun. But all that material is concentrated into a region only about 10 miles across, so they have enormous densities, something like a billion tons per teaspoonful, if you like. They are strongly magnetized, and they spin rapidly. And as anybody knows who's been involved with electrical phenomena, if you spin a magnet rapidly in the region where other conductors are present, you basically have a very strong electrical generator. So a spinning magnetized neutron star generates very strong electrical fields. Those, in turn, create what amounts to little more than static discharges, but at very high levels of energy. We all know those create radio noise, and the magnetic fields of the neutron stars cause those static crashes to generate noise that is channeled outward along the magnetic polar directions. And because of the spin of the star and the inclination between the polar axis and the spin axis, these beams of radio emission get swept around the sky at a rapid rate, so that from the point of view of an observer at some particular location in the galaxy, say on the planet Earth, you receive a pulse of radiation when a particular pulsar happens to be pointed in this direction. And so the reception of signals from pulsars amounts to a sequence of brief impulses that are timed according to the rotation rate of that particular pulsar. It turns out they keep time very accurately, and the work that turned out to be so important in the prize-winning discovery that I made in 1974 is basically a matter of taking advantage of the very accurate timing of the pulses that come off the neutron star and using those to do a detailed experiment in the relativistic nature of gravity.
But you were not recognized for this discovery until 19 years later in 1993, is that right?
Yeah, that's a bit of an unusual situation for Nobel Prize-winning research to have such a long delay. It turns out there's a good reason for it in this instance. It was immediately obvious at the time that Russ Hulse and I made this discovery in the 70s that there was a potential for applying the discovery to a very detailed and potentially important experiment. The effect that could, in principle, be measured would be one that, if detectable, would build up gradually over time. In fact, it turns out it builds up in a way that depends on the length of the duration of the experiment, if you like, the length of time since you start to take the data, not to the first power, but to the second power. So it's an effect that builds up quadratically with time. If we get a certain amount of an effect after 1 year, then in 2 years it's four times as big, and in 3 years it's nine times as big, and so forth. So it's an experiment that inherently rewards patience, and therefore it was clear that we could sort of begin this and keep it going for some time, repeating measurements and establishing higher and higher accuracy with a not just a, sort of the opposite of the law of diminishing returns. This is the law of increasing returns. And so it was clearly going to be worth pursuing as carefully as we could. Of course, in the meantime, we were also working on increasing the level of accuracy in other ways than just waiting for time to pass. And a combination of all those effects allowed us to make improvements that amounted to several orders of magnitude and to actually measure these very subtle effects of the relativistic nature of Einstein's theory of gravitation.
Pretty heady stuff.
Well, it's been lots of fun.
I've been speaking today with Nobel laureate Dr. Joe Taylor, K1JT, Dean of Faculty and Professor of Physics at Princeton University. We've been talking about his beginnings in amateur radio, the influence of amateur radio upon his career in astrophysics, and, of course, his being awarded the 1993 Nobel Prize for Physics for his work with pulsars. Next week, we'll look more at radio astronomy itself with Joe. We'll see you then. I'm Hap Holly, KCNRP, and this is the Rain Report.